This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These are people, these are flesh and blood human beings in these elected offices. And if anything happened to a single Democratic senator right now, if they were incapacitated or, God forbid, if they passed away, we'd lose the majority.
To most progressives, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a groundbreaking stalwart for the rule of law and a champion for the most vulnerable. But others resent the notorious RBG who, despite having cancer in her 80s, chose to not step down from the bench during the Obama administration. Her subsequent death allowed Donald Trump to fill a precious Supreme Court seat in his last year. This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our discussion with political consultant Aaron Huertas. We focus on the fact that some of the nation's most influential people are well past the average retirement age. We look at 83-year-old Stephen Breyer's seeming reluctance to retire from the Supreme Court, talk about California Senator Dianne Feinstein plowing ahead with re-election plans when she'll be 91, and explore possible solutions to an exceedingly delicate balance of power. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and this is the second half of my discussion with political consultant Aaron Huertas. So, Aaron, can you give us some examples of how activists and other leaders are trying to change the minds of a Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema when it comes to doing away with the filibuster?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is to realize that it's not just Manchin and Sinema, right? There's a lot of Democratic senators who have not explicitly said that they want to reform the filibuster. So you might have a relatively progressive senator or a senator who exhibits a lot of national leadership who still needs to hear from their constituents that this is a priority. And even the senators who are supportive of eliminating the filibuster, it's always worth saying, okay, great. You know, what are you doing about it? Is there something else that you would be willing to hold up because we haven't dealt with the filibuster yet? Like, can we keep hammering on this and going back to it? You look at somebody like Senator Klobuchar. She, following her presidential run, had much more of a national profile. Her committee on the Hill deals with voting rights and with election administration. And she's much more open to reforming the filibuster now. And part of that is seeing where the Republican Party is at. But part of that is also just a huge push from activists and from people who supported her presidential campaign. So we've seen some of that with Senator Sinema, like her former staffers spoke out. A lot of activists and donors who helped support her win in the Senate, which was crucial for taking back the Senate. Yeah, they've spoken out about this too. So she has room to move. I think she's in a similar position to somebody like Senator Ossoff in Georgia, where, you know, they're younger, they could have very long careers in the Senate. They're running in swing states where, you know, they're in potential danger of losing their seats in a way that senators from some deep blue states aren't. Similarly, Senator Tester from Montana, he's tried to persuade Senator Manchin and really just appealing to his sense of patriotism and kind of that deeper, older sense of bipartisanship that Republicans are portraying now. And he's somebody who could, you know, speak a little more credibly to Joe Manchin because he also has won really tough races in a relatively red state. But, you know, Manchin is just such an outlier politically because of how far to the right the West Virginia electorate has moved, or put it another way, how much the Republican Party has changed its coalition to make West Virginia much less competitive. So he might be the last of the Appalachian, you know, statewide Democrats at the federal level. And if he decides to retire, it's really hard to see how that seat gets taken back by a Democrat anytime in the future.
But in the same breath, what about... let's just hypothetically say that Manchin comes around this month. We won't be talking about Joe Manchin for the next couple of years, and his power is pretty much at an apex right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this with some of the negotiations around relief bills too, right? And I think this is also important to understand that, you know, senators have a lot of leverage as individuals in ways that, say, House members don't, right? Like, if you're an individual senator, you have the power to deny unanimous consent to move things forward. A lot of the Senate's business is done through unanimous consent. So it's really easy to just raise your hand and say, I object, and you slow things down a lot. And, you know, senators are busy people. They got schedules that, you know, they have lives. They want to go see their families. They all have to travel to D.C. to do business. So that threat of, okay, this guy's going to make us work through the weekend, you can do that, right? And so they do have that leverage as individuals. Chuck Schumer, as majority leader, he doesn't have the same leverage over Democratic senators that Nancy Pelosi has in the House over House members, right? When it comes to things like committee appointments or even how things run day to day. Power is really concentrated in the House at the speaker's in the speaker's office in a way that it's not for the majority leader in the Senate. So I think that part of it is tough. And with any of these reforms, I think it's very difficult for advocates because we're in the position of asking people who have succeeded in this system and asking people who have built great power in this system to change the system that they figured out. And I really hoped, you know, after the Georgia wins, that a lot of the Democratic senators would look at the electoral math. They would look at the races that are coming up. They would look at their thin majority. And they would say, good God, this might be our last chance in a generation to do some big stuff, to get rid of the filibuster, to do some court reform, to make D.C. a state, to maybe create a pathway for Puerto Rico to become a state, if Puerto Rico wants to become a state. And it's incredible to me that even given that confluence, we didn't see a rapid change among some of these holdout senators. We did see some rapid change among senators broadly. But if your future in the Senate is going to be in the minority and you're never going to chair a committee again versus you might have a chance to keep chairing a committee, it seems like you'd be more open to reform. But, you know, that hasn't happened. And I think that, you know, when Joe Manchin repeatedly says he doesn't want to revisit the filibuster, in the back of our minds, we got to think, well, you know what? He might be serious about that. And the clock is always ticking. Every legislative session, you know, a day in the Senate is worth more than a day out in the real world. There's only so many days that you can go and actually get legislative business done. And that window is really narrow, right? So it might not happen here. And I always want us thinking about our long game too. Katie Lauer, she's the co-director of West Virginia Can't Wait, which is a progressive advocacy group there. And, you know, she said after the election and after the Senate runoffs in Georgia specifically, national groups were just flooding her with phone calls and say, Katie, you got to tell us how to get to Manchin. You got to tell us how to flip Manchin's vote. And she said, look, I've been in West Virginia a long time. You can't, right? I think one of the more successful things in getting Manchin to flip a vote recently was on the PRO Act. And he hadn't been explicitly in favor of it, but he did come out in favor of it because he knows the unions are important in West Virginia. He supports the right to organize, and he came out in favor of it. I think there's some other holdouts who said, oh, you know, I support the right of workers to organize, but I don't know about this bill. Senator Warner in Virginia is one of those. And that's just up to unions and activists to keep plugging away. You know, that one might be doable, but then you got to get it through reconciliation too. But, you know, Lauer's main point when she spoke out was to say, you know, don't come to groups like mine after a big win to say, okay, what can we do now with a lot of late money, and can people come and parachute into West Virginia and convince Joe Manchin to do stuff? And her answer was no. And, you know, that's been my experience with working with organizers in some of these states where things are a lot politically tougher, you know, than they are in purely blue states. And it's like the long-term infrastructure has just got to be there. I did an event. Geez, this is a while ago now, but I did an event with Jeremy Richardson, and he's from West Virginia. He's a physicist. He jokes that he's the black sheep of his family because his brother's a coal miner and his dad was a coal mine manager. And Jeremy did a great event in Charleston, and it was about what do we want the future of West Virginia's economy to look like in 30 years. And so climate and clean energy were part of that conversation. Coal was part of that conversation, but he had it in a non-defensive way. He got a lot of, you know, state-level policymakers to show up. The union showed up. It was a great conversation. You know, it really fostered some good relationships for policymaking down the road. And one thing I distinctly remember from that was an activist telling me, you know, thank you all so much for doing this. This was through the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is a national advocacy group based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we had an office in DC, and this activist said, you know, national groups just ignore us. And they've given up on West Virginia. So thank you for coming here and thank you for remembering us. And please, you know, don't forget us. And that really stuck with me because for, you know, a national advocacy group with national fundraising base and, you know, big foundations, this was a little event in Charleston. You know, a couple of us got out there, put it together. Ken Ward showed up as a great local journalist there. And he got to ask a bunch of great questions of all these leading figures in state politics. And I feel like the advocacy that, you know, people at the national level can do if they form real long-term partnerships, if they do real infrastructure funding at the local level for some of these activist groups, that can really go a long way. And again, I think Stacey Abrams and the folks in Georgia, they've helped people internalize that lesson a bit. Like when Ossoff and Warnock were running in Georgia, they knew there was going to be a ton of money coming into that state, right? Because people wanted to take back the Senate. People were fired up for that race. And what they did that was very smart, and not just them, but a lot of other organizations, they encouraged people to just simply split their donations with the campaigns and the local groups. And that's really important because, you know, one, it's easy to do. If you're a progressive donor, you've seen an Act Blue page. Act Blue is a big piece of our progressive infrastructure for donations. And you can just split your donations. You can make that automatic for the folks when they land on the fundraising page. They know that it's going to be split. And that's really important because if a campaign win or lose, that campaign is gone in an election cycle. Campaigns are like startups that, you know, except when a startup succeeds, it becomes a giant monopoly that sticks around forever. When a campaign succeeds, they win. And then that person becomes a House member or senator and they go on to their next campaign and they kind of restart things, right? When a campaign loses, it's like poof. Right? Some of the data they leave stays there. Some other stuff stays there. People have that campaign experience, but you know, it's gone. They don't employ people anymore. By contrast, those local activist groups, right, they're going to be there for years. And they're not just going to work on elections. They're going to be doing year-round organizing. They're going to be working on policy. They're going to be talking to people and canvassing people all year long, not just about elections. So, you know, trying to figure out ways that we can get resources to local organizers as we also do national electoral politics. I'm fascinated by that. And I think the grassroots donor base in the Democratic Party has gotten a lot savvier with that because they have better access to information now than they did 10 or 20 years ago. And we've got, you know, these all-stars like Stacey Abrams who are just, you know, very directly making this case to people. And I think treating grassroots donors with the same respect and level of information that was usually reserved for, you know, high-level donors, really letting them in on that strategy and seeing how their money can have the most effect.
Come the feeling that it's always just started. Pull back your cover, I could love you for all time. But do it now, you know there's never next time.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to political consultant Aaron Huertas. We kept thinking, well, the Voting Rights Act is going to be the straw that breaks Manchin's back in the metaphorical sense, and that there'll be something that will just move the cinemas and mansions of the Senate to finally say, all right, enough's enough. These are not good actors that we're dealing with. And I saw that Ben Nelson, the former senator, has said that the Biden administration would be foolish to trust McConnell and the Republicans when it comes to trying to move good infrastructure legislation down the road, that they're being played. It seems like any Democrat who's working in good faith with a Republican on the Hill right now is being played, because the Republican Party only answers to one person right now, and he's nuts.
I think the 1-6 Commission is a huge wake-up call on that. We've already had so many wake-up calls, though, and you know, my experience is in climate policy. So I've seen the Republican Party walk away from climate policy, you know, long, long time ago, right? So maybe climate change wasn't the canary in the coal mine. There's a lot of other issues that can maybe lay claim to that too, including reproductive freedom. But on climate, in particular, you know, we really did try a bipartisan approach in 2008, 2009. And once the Tea Party came up, it was probably hopeless for us to try to get anything through the Senate. And folks, you know, folks remember this when you remind them of it in my experience, but like, Democrats had a supermajority. They had the ability to pass a lot of legislation. The president still wanted it to be bipartisan. That was falling apart. You know, he asked Chuck Grassley at the end of the day, is there anything I can do with this healthcare bill, with Obamacare, to get you on it? And he said, Mr. President, I guess not, right after months and months of negotiation. And meanwhile, you know, during that legislative process, Senator Ted Kennedy, he passed away, right? And I think about that often. A couple weeks ago, Patrick Leahy went to the hospital, and my heart was in my throat, right? These are people, these are flesh and blood human beings in these elected offices. And if anything happened to a single Democratic senator right now, if they were incapacitated, or God forbid, if they passed away, we'd lose the majority.
In certain states, right? I mean, like Dianne Feinstein's about to turn 88. She thinks she can run again. But if she were to pass away or be incapacitated, have to resign, there's a Democratic governor and she would be replaced by a Democrat. But I think in Vermont, it would be tricky because you have a Republican, but a progressive Republican in Vermont who says he would have replaced Leahy with a Democrat, I believe. But that's still in play, right?
He said if Sanders had become president and or, you know, perhaps received an appointment or been a VP or whatever the circumstance was, he said he would not appoint a Republican. So, you know, it's hard to say, would he play around with that a little bit? Would he give you someone who's a Democrat in name only? Would he appoint another independent like Sanders, but an independent who's more conservative? You know, who's to say? And also even in states where you could say, okay, well, you know, there'd still be a Democrat there, you'd still lose time. Right. So are they just appointing someone? How quickly can they do that? When are they going to hold a special election? It, you know, if at all, how does that go? It can vary a little bit. But that loss of time, you know, that really hurts. And in Ted Kennedy's case, you know, we lost that seat. But you know, even if we hadn't, you lost time there. And they had to do some legislative maneuvering to get the healthcare bill through. So, I used to say it varies a lot by issue. Right. So climate, probably not, but maybe something like infrastructure or transportation. You still had enough incentive for Republicans to come on board and say, yeah, you know, I like this. I want to go back home and I want to do some ribbon cutting ceremonies. You know, I'm going to vote for this. And Joe Biden and other Democrats have made fun of this. Now what we're seeing is Republicans that our media environment is so whack and the local media environment is so decimated that a lot of Republicans look at something like the infrastructure bill, they say, oh, I get to have my cake and eat it too. I get to vote no on this, and I get to go to the ribbon cutting ceremony. So that really takes some gall, but it is the reality of what's happening. I've seen a ton of bad faith negotiation from Republicans on climate, right? And a lot of demands for changes that don't actually result in any votes. There still are a handful of Republicans in the House and in the Senate who do want to do bipartisan stuff and do want to come along. But folks need to realize that's a really, really small part of the party. It's not the part of the party that's in charge. And unfortunately, it's not enough in the party to actually get good stuff done. So that is really worrisome. And I think to your point, a lot of senators are probably averaging out their lifetime of experience a little bit, right? So if you've been at it for 20, 30, 40 years, is the last 2 years the most important thing in your mind when you're weighing political decisions? Maybe your average is, somewhere around 2007, when I wish it was more like 2019 or 2020 at least. And then the other thing you got to keep in mind, these senators, and this is true for House members too, these elected officials at the federal level, they really do live in a different information environment than we do, even as activists. And it's really, you know, it's idiosyncratic to each member, kind of what their reality is and who they listen to and who their trusted advisors are. But importantly for this conversation, if you're Manchin, if you're Sinema, if you're some of these Democratic senators who have actually done some bipartisan stuff over time that you're proud of, and you have relationships with Republican senators who will talk to you about this, that's a very different reality than, you know, what we see as observers when we're looking at the results. And, you know, McConnell even advised his caucus, be very nice to Joe Manchin, be very nice to these other senators. You know, this is important for us. And, the, you know, the derisive take on that is like, well, everybody loves talking to a salesman, right? But the reality is, you know, somebody like Manchin, he was able to get bipartisan COVID relief under Trump, right, at the end of the Trump administration. So he's seen his methods work. And I think the reality now is, okay, but, you know, what we're seeing is that none of these methods are going to work on something like voting rights. None of these methods are going to work on something like the PRO Act. So what then? Do we get left behind? And again, you know, I take these senators at their words when they say they do not support doing anything about the filibuster. And another way of thinking about that, if you're an activist, lobbyist, an advocate, if you have that kind of mindset, is, you know, they're saying that their incentives don't align with mine, right? So then you really got to think long term and say, how do you change the incentives? How do you do the local organizing that convinces them that this is a winning strategy, this gets them what they want, and maybe eliminating the filibuster even leads to more bipartisanship, because now it's the only way you can have an effect on anything is to go convince the other side that, you know, they should join up with you. And now they, you know, they can get a little bipartisan glean on something if they're really going to go ahead and threaten to do stuff 50-50.
What are the secrets they trace in the sky? And why do you tremble each time they ride by? Throw out your gold teeth and see how they roll. The answer they reveal, life is unreal.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to political consultant Aaron Huertas. Without being ageist, how does somebody like yourself, Aaron, approach trying to get some of these powerful people to step aside due to age?
I think there's a big opportunity with the next Congress, and we should talk about judicial reform too. So when Democrats took back the majority in 2018, there was the race to see who would be Speaker of the House among the Democrats. As part of that negotiation, Pelosi and her leadership team said, we're going to take a look at the leadership structure in the House and how that works. And that look has not resulted in any changes to policy. It came up a little bit again in 2020. I think if we weren't dealing with the immediate election emergency with Trump, it might have been a little bit different. I expect this to come up again in 2022, whether Democrats retain their House majority or not. If in particular, if Pelosi steps down and decides not to run again or not to serve a final term as Speaker. But the age issue in the House is downstream of how seniority works on the House committees. So on the Democratic side, there's no limits to your chairmanship. So it tends to be once you're chair, you just stay chair for a while, right? So if you've been, John Dingell, chaired the Energy and Commerce Committee for a long time, right? You have these House committee chairs who just wield that gavel for years and years and never give it up. It's pretty sweet to be the chair of a committee, right? You get to make really big decisions. You get to decide what the legislation is. On the Republican side, there are term limits to chairing a committee. So you often see, or I should say it's more likely for a Republican to retire when they hit some of those term limits. And that goes back to younger Republican legislators in their coalition saying, look, I'm not interested in waiting everyone out in this House seat for 20, 30 years to finally become the chair of a committee. I want to get a crack at it earlier. And that was the compromise from some of the older Republicans. Well, why don't we term limit the chairs, right? And part of that was negotiated through Newt Gingrich taking over as Speaker. So that hasn't happened on the Democratic side. But again, that's just the House. The Senate has always operated through seniority. And I think it's tough because that gets to the political economy of the Senate and how weird it is too, right? So we've got, who are two of the longest serving oldest senators? So you got Patrick Leahy and Bernie Sanders, who are two of the most progressive champion senators who I really like having in the Senate because I'm a progressive, Leahy and Sanders. Who do I love being chair of the Senate Budget Committee? Bernie Sanders, right? That gives progressives a lot of leverage too.
But how do we convince people like Ginsburg and Breyer or a Feinstein that they're doing the country a disservice by playing with this very razor thin margin of that we have in the Republic, all balancing on their survival at a very advanced age? I mean, 88 years old, that's old. As a public figure, it's acceptable to be 88 years old and one of the most powerful people in the country. But if you were 88 years old and you were a cardiologist operating on a person, I think a lot of patients would have significant pause, right?
Yeah, so there are some creative ways to think about the incentive structure there. So we talked about, you know, can you alter the rules around committee chairmanships? And I'm generally against age limits for elected officials simply because I could see that get manipulated in a way that targets specific politicians, right? And you'd never want an acuity test or something like that. It's very easy to see how politicians could game systems like that to try to go after specific politicians. But I do think changing the incentive structures around how long you hold a committee chair, that can make a lot of sense. I also think that there could be retirement benefits to retiring earlier. The party could, you know, put an emphasis on just recruiting younger candidates, but that's tough because if you're younger, you tend to have less of the, you know, less name recognition. There's different incentives you can play around with. I think on the federal bench, there are much more stringent policy changes you could do. And again, I think age limits can get dicey. And I think acuity tests would get gamed immediately, especially if you had lawyers trying to, you know, accuse a judge of not being all with it as part of their case, right? They would have that incentive right away. But if we had a system on the Supreme Court where you could step down to emeritus judgeship, right, and keep doing some stuff, you don't have to fully give up your power, but you're not on the 5-4 votes anymore, right? Something like that. And unfortunately, strategic retirements are the norm, but we now have two Democratic Supreme Court justices who have not been invested in strategic retirements. And that's Ginsburg, which did not work out, is very upsetting. And now Breyer, who's saying, he was talking to a bunch of law students, and his advice for them for persuading Republicans was, you know, just talk to them and keep saying things until they find something you agree with. And he's very resistant to this idea that strategic retirements politicize the judiciary. And that, to me, that puts the onus on the judges to not politicize the judiciary. It's really the Republican Party that's politicized the judiciary and has appointed much more conservative and right-wing judges and younger judges to try to take over the judiciary as much as possible. So I don't know what you can do to convince a Supreme Court justice to do that sort of stuff.
Always appreciate your input, and I think we agree that some creative solutions are long overdue. Aaron Huertas, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, sure thing.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Duke Ellington and Charles Mingus, and The English Beat. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.